You are listening to Lighthearted, the official podcast of the United States Lighthouse Society. My name is Jeremy D'Entremont. Welcome. Today is May 5th, 2024, and this is episode 276 of Lighthearted. Today, our interview is about an hour long. I think it's a really interesting one. I'm going to get right into the introduction here. Our subject today is the Maine Maritime Museum. Located in the historic shipbuilding city of Bath, Maine, the Maine Maritime Museum has roots that go back to 1962. It was then that a small group of local residents formed the Marine Research Society of Bath. In 1975, a former shipyard on the Kennebec River was donated and became the new site of the Maine Maritime Museum. The museum has grown substantially since its early days. Today, the 20-acre campus includes exhibits dedicated to the past, present, and future of Maine's storied waterways, and the museum is now one of the top 20 tourist attractions in the state. For lighthouse buffs, there's an exhibit called Into the Lantern, a Lighthouse Experience. The centerpiece of the exhibit is a second-order Fresnel lens that once served in the East Lighthouse of the famous Two Lights in Cape Elizabeth, Maine. Opening this past February, the exhibit Lost and Found Sounds of the Maine Coast is a collaboration between Diane Ballin and the Maine Maritime Museum. The exhibit looks at navigational warning systems from buoys to foghorns, past and present. It investigates the idea of lost and found maritime sounds and invites visitors to reflect on how sound affects our individual and collective memory. Our guests today are Catherine Sear, the Associate Curator of the Maine Maritime Museum, and sound artist Diane Ballin, who is the creative mind behind the new sound exhibit. I go pretty far back with this museum. I first visited in the 1980s, and I've been there many times. It was great to be back. So let's listen to my conversation with Catherine Sear and Diane Ballin now. I am here today at the Maine Maritime Museum in beautiful Bath, Maine, and I am speaking with Associate Curator Catherine Sear and sound artist Diane Ballin. Catherine and Diane, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks very much.
And thank you for hosting me at the museum today, Catherine.
Of course.
I appreciate that. Always great coming here. I have a history of this place that goes back to the 1980s. Before we get into the sound exhibit, the Lost and Found, the Sounds of the Maine Coast exhibit we're going to talk quite a bit about today and other exhibits, just a little bit about you, Catherine, okay? Mm-hmm. You are the associate curator of the museum,
yeah.
Right? I'm sure you do all kinds of things. It's probably a little hard to explain in a sentence or two. But what are some of the things you do, like, on a daily basis here?
Yeah, I mean, the real joy of this job is that every day is a little different. I always say to myself I could never have worked in a regular 9-to-5 office environment because I love getting my hands in all sorts of different pots. And so in the case of being a curator here at the museum, I have the opportunity to work on exhibits, and that stems from research within our own collection, but also collaborations with wonderful people like Diane. I'm helping researchers with their questions, whether it's tracing their history of their great-great-grandfather who was a sea captain, or looking for an image of a vessel. I'm walking around, talking with people, getting their insight into what's happening in the museum and what they're interested in, and just making sure that the stories that we're telling here are fun, exciting, and interactive.
Well, from what I've seen, you're doing a good job at all of that.
So. Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
You're right out there in the front lines, for sure. So I do want to talk again about the really great sound exhibit that's here right now. But let's start by discussing the museum in general. Catherine, can you tell me a little bit about the history of this very historic site where the museum is located?
Absolutely. So the Maine Maritime Museum sits on a 20-acre campus with multiple buildings, with the sort of star of the show being the Percy and Small Shipyard, which remains the only shipyard with wooden buildings intact that built wooden vessels left in the entire country. Wow. Now, there's a lot of qualifiers in there, but it is really significant in that sense. We ended up acquiring the site in the 1970s, and it has been over 50 years now of stewardship, mm-hmm. to tell the story of Bath Shipbuilding, specifically that happened in these buildings and on this site. Now, within that 20 acres, we also encompass two other shipyards. On the south side of our campus, we have the Deering Shipyard, and on the north side, we have the Donnell Shipyard. Mm-hmm. So all in together, so much history just within our grounds.
Yeah. Bath, I believe, is known as the City of Ships.
It is. It is. We have had active shipbuilding here in the city of Bath since the 1780s. Mm-hmm. And so that means, you know, the big wooden schooners of the old day, the clipper ships, even the massive Wyoming that we love to talk about here that was built in the Percy and Small Shipyard. Mm-hmm. But that also includes the active shipbuilding that is happening literally right next door at Bath Iron Works, who are creating destroyers for the U.S. Navy. Mm-hmm. So it's this really long history. And in that time, since the 1780s, we've had over 2,500 vessels launched from the city of Bath.
Wow.
And that includes up to present day timing. And in total on the Kennebec, we're talking about over 5,000 vessels.
Holy
so
cow.
Bath is just kind of this one yet very important small part of a much larger legacy of shipbuilding on Maine's rivers.
Right. And I'll also mention, just made me think of it, my late stepfather was descended, his name was Merriman, M-E-R-Y-M-A-N, which is a big name in shipbuilding around Casco Bay, and especially Harpswell near here.
Yeah.
So he was descended from the captains and shipbuilders there.
Oh, that's so cool.
So that was part of how I got interested in all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an amazing legacy around here. So the museum, you just talked about the shipyards and everything, but the campus of the museum is about 20 acres, right?
Yeah.
And if I have it right, are there 15 buildings?
I think that's about right.
And you could spend days here easily.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, our admissions is good for 2 days within a 7-day period because we consistently get feedback from our visitors saying, oh my gosh, there was so much to see, I have to come back.
Yeah.
Well, we build that right into our admission ticket pricing and everything because we know folks do, especially like if the weather isn't as great one day, but you really want to go and explore the outside, you could spend one day, about a half day inside the buildings, in the main building, and then go outside the next day.
Yeah. Good deal.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you get asked this a lot. Somebody might say, oh, I'm coming, I only have a couple hours, what should I see? It probably depends on the person, obviously. But
yes.
Yeah.
I would say start with the Maritime History Building. That's the main site that you come in, buy your tickets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can go to the museum store and buy some fun stuff. That has our temporary rotating exhibits, and those I always highlight as something for folks to see, considering that they do change quite often, so you're always going to find something new. Mm-hmm. And then I think any time that you can spend out in the shipyard and experiencing the buildings of Percy and Small and understanding how these massive vessels were built by hand on this site, and kind of the capstone piece of all of that is, of course, the Wyoming evocation, where you can actually see the size of the Wyoming.
Evocation is a good way of putting it. It's kind of like a framework.
It's a framework, essentially. Yeah. So it sort of shows the hull and the mast. So the mast actually would have been even taller than what is there. There's some regulations and just building material limitations with that.
Mm-hmm.
But thinking about this vessel that launched in the early 1900s to carry coal, it's just massive.
I believe you can actually kind of see the tallest mast as you're coming towards the museum from a distance, right?
Yeah, you absolutely can. And I think it's really cool because as you're doing such, you're driving past BIW and you're seeing modern active shipbuilding happening. And then you sort of transition back to the past of the great wooden schooners and the tradition of wooden shipbuilding.
BIW being the Bath Iron Works, which you mentioned earlier, which is General Dynamics runs that, right?
Correct.
It's, if I remember right, it's like the largest employer in the state
of
Maine.
It is the largest single site employer in Maine, which I believe it's between 5,000-6,000 employees at this point. It had larger periods of employment or larger numbers of people at various points, especially like during the two world wars. But it still is a massive asset to the community as an employer and sort of as an entity within the city of Bath.
Yeah, and it's just, a mile or two down the waterfront here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, very, very close. A neighbor here, yeah. You mentioned research before. Does the museum and you specifically, do you help researchers?
Of course. So, you know, people contact us via the phone, via email, sometimes even by written letter to ask questions. I'll say a lot of the times it's, you know, family related, trying to do ancestry and just piece puzzles together about yourself and your history. But other other times it's people who are working on scholarly articles or doing a presentation and need an image of a specific schooner or brig or something for their presentation. And so we are able to do that. And we have lots of resources, thankfully, online that people can connect to even on their own if they want to. Mm-hmm. And that includes our entire objects collections database is online, thanks to our use of the Past Perfect collections database software. Uh-huh. And so you can find that right on our website. Yeah. And you can go in and keyword search if you are looking for figureheads or you want to see fish hooks or
lighthouse pictures.
Or lighthouse things. Exactly. There's all sorts of stuff that you can go and find. And we just completed a very large 2-year project to really ramp up our catalogings for mm-hmm. better descriptions, better keywords, and also images. Mm-hmm. Because that's really the best way that people can access. We understand that not everybody can make their way to Bath, but the internet is in almost everybody's pockets these days.
Right.
So that in terms of objects, and then we have a profile through Internet Archive, and we have mm-hmm. a lot of our materials digitized on that. So going through different collections of papers, mm-hmm. some photographs, all of that stuff. Really fun to just search through and see what you can find.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I was just looking at some of that the other day, and I was going to mention also it's kind of what we're doing at the U.S. Lighthouse Society as well. We're trying to get as much as we can online for researchers with the Lighthouse Research Catalog as mm-hmm. well. So I want to get back to some of the other exhibits we're going to talk about, but one of the main reasons we're here today is I want to talk about Diane's exhibit, Diane Ballin here. Diane, you are known as a sound artist, right? I was looking at your background. You have a really extensive background in audio production and sound design, among other things. So what led you to all that? How did you get into that career?
I actually have a visual arts background from Massachusetts College of Art. Oh. I have a degree in fine arts. And after college, I was listening to National Public Radio's All Things Considered. And every now and then, there would be a sound piece that would come on the airwaves that literally stopped me in my tracks. Hmm. It wasn't a journalist reporting on such and such. It was very, very sound rich. Hmm. And I remember at one point I stood there and said, I really want to do this. And it was a long road to hoe for me because I didn't have any training. The other part of the NPR piece was I was really impressed with the broadcast quality of the productions. So not only did I want to do this, but I really wanted to achieve that kind of broadcast quality. Mm-hmm. So I actually got in touch with the engineer at National Public Radio for recommendations on recording equipment. Mm-hmm. And he had three packages, excellent, very good, and good. And I couldn't afford the excellent. So I chose the very good, which was, believe it or not, a Sony TCM 5000 cassette recorder.
Okay.
In the days of cassette recording and an electro voice microphone. And that actually is how I started. I have had my pieces air on National Public Radio's All Things Considered. Mm-hmm. And just to give you an idea of how far back I started all this, my early pieces I was submitting to NPR on reel-to-reel tape. I was cut and splicing reel-to-reel tape.
Well, it's not that amazing to me. We're not that different in age. So I went to college and actually majored in filmmaking, actual film, not video, but cutting film and everything. So I'm a dinosaur, too.
There you go.
I was reading about some of your projects over the years, and I believe you did something pretty extensive with bird sounds. Is that right?
Yes. I am a bird watcher, and what I do love about bird watching and bird watchers is that they hear the world the way that I do. Our ears are so open to sound that any faint scratch in the leaves has us looking for a white-throated sparrow, which is where you would find somebody scratching in the leaves. And so I meet up with birders on the trail, particularly during the migrations. I actually bird year-round. And during the migrations, there would be birders telling me stories about particular birds, the first time they saw a particular bird or whatever. So not only did I want to collect the field recordings of bird sounds, but I also collected the stories that birders had about their love of bird watching.
Mm-hmm.
I created two sound installations, one called Give Me Your Tired, Your Tattered Bird Books. And if anybody knows about birding field guides, it's the book.
Peterson.
Yes, it's the book that you throw in the back of your car. You can bend the cover, you can get it wet. And I had the birders loan me their field guides, and I displayed the field guides, and then I recorded the birders' memories and recollections about the books so people could view the books and listen with headphones to the stories. Mm-hmm. The other installation was in the field, and that was a series of 16 separate mixes which ran openly in the gallery.
Where is this?
This was at USM Atrium Gallery.
University of Southern Maine.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of crossover, you know, between lighthouse nuts and birders. There's definitely some who fall into both categories. So let's move on to the exhibit here. Lost and Found, Sounds of the Maine Coast, which I just had the privilege of looking around and listening to just before we started here today. So how was that exhibit conceived?
I've been working on a coastal sound series, recording in both Maine and in the Arctic,
mm-hmm.
and I got a Maine Artist Fellowship from the Maine Arts Commission, which was right in the middle of the pandemic, and so I thought, okay, I will concentrate and spend a full year recording on the coast of Maine for this coastal sound series. I actually had enough recordings that I began to do presentations.
Mm.
And because it was a pandemic, this was via Zoom, and found that there are a lot of audiences that, you know, it was just wonderful to be able to sort of pass on the idea of the beauty of sound. And then I had the idea, because it was going so well, I said, I'm going to approach museums.
Mm-hmm.
And when I thought of the Maine Maritime Museum, I said, I'm not going to ask them about a presentation. I'm going to submit a proposal for an exhibition of my Maine coastal sounds. So Catherine just started out, and I found her name and her email address, sent the email.
Mm-hmm.
I received an email back probably about maybe a week and a half later. On a late Friday afternoon, I was like, do I want to open this and be depressed all weekend? Or, you know, because the life of an artist is one of many rejections. And so I said, if I go through the weekend, I don't open, I'll be wondering. And I opened it, and Catherine said, yes, we're interested.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
I had a feeling she said that.
Yeah, Diane had quite literally contacted me within a week or two of me starting here at the museum in June of 22.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were at a really interesting and sort of new space and time at the museum. We'd had some, you know, changes in staff, and I was coming in and hoping to just breathe, you know, fresh air, think about ways that I could use my background and my experience to help the museum tell new stories. And so one of the things that I was really interested in doing when I came to the museum was finding ways to work with our community, and particularly work with local artists. So it was kind of two birds, one stone, in a sense, when Diane contacted me. And I said, yeah, let's see what this is about. It sounds interesting. We haven't really done something quite like this before in my mm-hmm. knowledge of the museum's programming and exhibitions in the past. And Diane and I struck up a wonderful friendship that turned into a really awesome exhibit.
And a podcast interview.
And a podcast interview.
And you worked pretty closely together on the exhibit, right? I just went through it, and you gave me a kind of an overview when we got to the exhibit, and you wrote a lot of the text that's in the exhibit, of course, Catherine.
Yeah, so my kind of hope had been with the exhibition that we would be able to take Diane's work and the way that she thinks so, I think, critically and interestingly about sound, and bring that to our audiences, but also ground it with historical knowledge. You know, people are coming into a museum, they want to learn something, or at least hopefully they want to learn something. So it was, how do we contextualize Diane's work into the larger sense of how sound has played a role in maritime environments, and how we could use collection objects to help tell that, as well as Diane's work. So it became sort of a beautiful sort of combination of the two to be able to do it all in one space.
That's great. Kind of got a life of its own, I guess.
Yeah.
So the title of the exhibition is Lost and Found, Sounds of the Maine Coast. What does lost and found mean in that title?
Yes, well, lost, the lost sound goes back to meeting you, Jeremy. And I was wanting to record the iconic sound of the foghorn at Portland Headlight. I did my usual. I always record at the crack of dawn, so there's not a lot of people, not a lot of cars sound, and I needed a foggy day. Mm-hmm. And so I went to the lighthouse, set up my equipment, turned on record, and I did not hear the foghorn sound. Interestingly, I did hear the whistle buoy, very mm-hmm. faint in the distance, that sounds similar to a foghorn, but I knew it was not the foghorn.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I went back home, did some research, found an article from like 2017 that 16 Maine lighthouses were converted to a new sound system called MRAS, Mariner Radio Activated Sound System. And it devastated me. It meant that on a foggy day, a foghorn would no longer sound automatically. Mariners can tune in to a radio to a certain frequency to start the foghorn. So I contacted the Coast Guard, and they sent me a 455-page government document.
That of course you read, right?
Right.
Yeah, cover to cover.
That had two sets of page numbers and had to be updated weekly. So I contacted the Maine Historical Society and said, do you know anyone who knows anything about lighthouses and foghorns? And that's how I got your name, Jeremy. And I think, Jeremy, if you hadn't told me that somebody at Portland Headlight has a radio and turns on the foghorn for the visitors, I'm not sure how long it would have taken me to find somebody to make that recording. So I did make the recording.
I heard it. Yeah.
Which is part of the exhibit.
Yeah.
And also to note, on a clear morning.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, when you're talking about the MRAS system, since that was installed at these places, you never hear those horns except on sunny days when somebody going by in their sailboat or whatever it might be has a VHF radio and they're showing off to a friend, look what I can do with my radio. I'm at Portsmouth Harbor Lighthouse in New Hampshire. I have been a lot over the last few years, and some of the other local lighthouses, and I've been there at these places in the fog, and you never hear them in the fog anymore. So I'm afraid their use for navigation may be passing us, receding to the past at this point. I don't know if you have any feelings about that.
It breaks my heart, actually. Yeah. And nostalgia-wise, I remember that particular weekend, I said, I'm going to drive down to Nubbelite in mm-hmm. York on a wild, foggy, rainy day without my equipment to see, just to see if I could hear the foghorn, because I didn't see it on the list at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, who can I call to maybe save me this trip? So I called the York Chamber of Commerce, mm-hmm. and a woman answered, and I asked her if she was aware of the new sound system. She was not, and she said, this breaks my heart. I grew up listening to that sound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course the modern electric or electronic foghorns, it's a nice sound. It's a beautiful sound in its own way, but it's very different from the older horns, the air horns and steam horns before that. And I'm sure you know those were pretty powerful.
Mm-hmm.
luckily, some of those have been recorded and preserved, the sounds. So again, the title is Lost and Found. So those are some of the sounds that are have been lost or are being lost. But what does so what does found mean in the title?
For me, the found sounds are the objects that I recorded actually from the museum's collection.
Mm-hmm.
And most of those sounds have not been heard for over 100 years. It was an absolute, I was absolutely astonished that I was able to find these objects. The story behind that is initially I thought it'd be really nice to have a couple objects in the exhibit, like an old skiff.
Mm-hmm.
So I searched skiffs, and there were many skiffs that came up. So I said, I wonder if the museum would have any foghorns. And when I hit return, about 6 to 8 foghorns came up to my absolute astonishment.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't believe it. I was like, this is such a goal. I want to record these. They were not your usual horn-shaped foghorns.
Right.
Most were the, which we have in the exhibit, the Lothrop foghorns, which is a wooden box with a horn sticking out on one side,
mm-hmm.
a hand pump on the top.
Yeah.
And so you hand pump with a lever inside the box. It fills the bellows with air, and it blows the horn.
Uh-huh.
And so in all my excitement of this adventure of finding these objects, which I couldn't believe,
yeah.
I had forgotten that they may be too fragile to make a sound. So I contacted Catherine, said, you know, here's the list of what I'm interested in recording.
Mm-hmm.
And not only foghorns, then of course I looked up bells and whistles. And we had this sort of ongoing joke because I would always be saying, when can I come and record all the bells and whistles?
Yeah.
And so that idiom was being thrown around literally. So I had to wait a while, and it was just an absolute honor to be able to see the objects in person,
yeah.
for one thing, because I had been looking at them through a photograph online. They actually, like, set up two carts for me when I arrived, and oh, it's just beautiful.
Yeah, I do. I remember your reaction. It was so visceral of just like, oh my God, I get to actually like play with them in a sense.
Yeah.
And of course, from my perspective, from, you know, on the curatorial end, I was thinking about, you know, collection stewardship, that we are stewards of these objects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're supposed to cause no harm, do no harm in a sense. You know, we are there for the public to have these objects and preserve them for the future. And so I took the lists that Diane was able to populate thanks to our online database,
mm-hmm.
and go through collection storage and say immediately, nope, that one's too fragile. Like, that one's not going to do anything. Or, okay, this one looks sturdy enough. Let's see if I crank that lever, is anything going to happen?
Yeah.
And so I, you know, my colleagues joked that they remember the day when all of a sudden just toots and horns and blares and whatever just came out of collection storage,
yeah.
because I was testing these objects. And so, you know, I'm trained as a material culturist. I look at objects and as them being sort of a vehicle and a window to our history. And, you know, I always think about, well, if an object can't be used in the way that it was intended, what is its value anymore? Like, I always like to tell people, like, well, if a chair sits in a museum and no one sits in it, is it a chair anymore?
Huh.
Right? Like, those kind of hypothetical, yeah. questions are what go through my mind,
mm-hmm.
and the way that I've, you know, studied objects and decorative arts. And so the fact that we could bring back this part of this object's history and share it again with the public far outweighed any sort of damage that could or potentially been done to the object. And none happened, but it was really important to me to be able to say, hey, we can do this, and
yeah.
this is another part of that object's history.
Now you have really good recordings of the sounds that those things make, so
yeah.
you probably don't have to go through all that again.
Right. We were very thorough with our recordings.
Yeah. And it's definitely one of the highlights of the exhibit. I love seeing those machines, these sound machines that are on display, but also hearing the sounds, your recordings. And is there, do I remember, what's the name of one of them? Is it the Little Giant? Or?
Yes.
Yeah, it's the Little Giant Foghorn, which I wrote, you know, a big name for a small sound.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of more like a bicycle horn, maybe,
yep.
a toot, toot, toot. It's pretty hilarious. So where did those come from originally? Do we know where they were used? One says Norwegian, is it Norwegian steamship?
The Norwegian foghorn, so there are two types. Mm-hmm. There's the Lothrop, as Diane mentioned earlier, which was actually invented and patented by an individual born in Appleton, Maine, okay. but later then worked and spent most of his adult life in Gloucester, Massachusetts, of course, another really important site of a working waterfront. Mm-hmm. In New England. And then the Norwegian one is a rotary style, so you actually turn it. So mm-hmm. the functionality and the mechanics of it are slightly different. Unfortunately, we were not able to record any of the Norwegian style boxed foghorns because of just the condition and issues, and they quite literally didn't play when we moved the lever.
Yeah.
So most of the foghorns, we don't have a ton of provenance for. The fact that we know that the Lothrop at least was made and designed by someone with a Maine sort of history mm-hmm. in and of itself is pretty significant. But we don't necessarily know what vessel they were aboard or who owned them. Yeah. You know, most of them came into the museum pretty early on in like the 70s mm-hmm. When record keeping wasn't necessarily as good. We're far, far more thorough these days because we know to be better about that now. But that's kind of the beauty of going through collections like our own, is some things have really detailed histories and others don't. But in this case, and the way that we're presenting these foghorns and the other objects, it's not necessarily who owned it, but it's the why did they exist and what did they do that's the real importance and what we're trying to get across with the storyline here.
Sure.
I was remembering, Catherine, when we found the patent to the Lothrop foghorns mm-hmm. and the curiosity of why the foghorn was high-pitched as a sound versus the, you know, typical low, mournful, wonderful, bassy sound of a foghorn, and how in that first paragraph or so it was used as a ship's horn.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, the box size allowed it to be essentially portable. I mean, having now lifted them on and off shelves and put them in cases, they're not the easiest to move around, and I mean, I'm not the biggest person either, but they at least are technically portable in the way that, you know, the foghorn that you would expect at a lighthouse or a big giant brass bell is not. But you could sit it, you know, at least on the deck and be able to have it there.
Mm-hmm. I have a question about something in the exhibit from the museum collection, something else that was on a ship, but a ship's bell. And it says from the steamship Portland. Was that the Portland that sank in 1898, one of the biggest shipwrecks in New England history?
As far as we understand, yes. That's the history that is attached to that object.
Wow.
Now, did it come off pre-shipwreck?
Right. That's
probably, because, well, I don't. It doesn't look like it came out of the ocean if right. you know, given its condition. It probably was replaced at some point. But yes, the steamer Portland.
That's, yeah, absolutely one of the most famous shipwrecks in New England history. Yeah. Yes.
And also, one thing that I found very moving was not only could we have the actual objects that I recorded the sounds from, mm-hmm. but also other objects from those particular ships on exhibit.
Yeah.
There was a beautiful little drawing of the tugboat Seguin example.
Mm-hmm.
And also with the Seguin, and I kept saying to Catherine, because this exhibit was almost 2 years in the making. I think it was a year and three quarters.
Yeah.
Yeah. I found a little file folder with a stencil cut out that said Seguin.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is unbelievable. This little piece of paper had made it to the collection, to me, and now to everybody in this exhibit. So I kept saying to Catherine, I'm really going to fight to keep this little piece of paper in the exhibit.
You didn't have to fight too hard. I think, you know, in our early conversations with each other and about your work, obviously there were connections. You know, I was also kind of distraught to learn that the foghorns at lighthouses don't go off, because I myself, you know, growing up in Maine, have very distinct memories. My grandfather would help a buddy lobster fish off the coast of Port Clyde, and you know, so I remember Marshall Point Lighthouse and going along in the boat and hearing that, and so those things touched with me. But another thing that kept coming up was the ephemeral aspect of sound, mm-hmm. and the fact that it is elusive in many ways. And so, you know, I think of, you know, quite literally ephemera, the papers that we have here in the collection that aren't necessarily supposed to survive, but have, and like Diane said, made their way into our collection.
Yeah.
And so I like to be able to make those connections for people, because I think it helps bring yet another level of understanding and thinking of, how does sound work? How do we remember sound? But how do we remember other things? And sometimes it's through a piece of paper or a stencil on a fire fold or a file folder or a little drawing. But sometimes it's the audio recording that we have from a concert, or, you know, the kid's birthday party or something, you know? So those are aspects that I think really come out in the show.
Interesting thinking about sound as being so ephemeral, and you know, some of those old gadgets, equipment you're talking about, that you couldn't produce sound with them again. So that's gone.
Right.
But you can still hear some of them, and because you were able to record these, in a sense, they're no longer ephemeral, because we have them.
Yeah.
We have the record of them.
Exactly.
We have
them. Yeah.
Which is tremendous.
And just the thought of somebody on the coast of Maine actually hand pumping, striking. Creating those sounds, but 100 years ago.
Yeah.
It's just amazing to me.
Yeah. And you've also got the fog bell, the sound of a fog bell from the Kennebec River Doubling Point range lights.
Mm-hmm.
Such a beautiful sound.
Isn't that? Yes.
It's a really rich sound. And the bell from those range lights is actually here on the grounds of the museum.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, it is. So. And you can go right up and ring it yourself, which is what's so great. So in the summertime, it's so awesome to just, you know, be sitting outside and hearing or eating my lunch and then hearing just ding, 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 because kids have so much fun. And I should say adults, because adults like to have fun as well. going ahead and ringing it. And it's really wonderful that we have it on the campus. And I love that we were able to record it so that people can hear a recording of it, but then go and experience themselves. And then also look out across the water, across the river, and see Doubling Point. And if they happen to go on a cruise, they then can see the fog bell tower that the bell originally hung from.
Fiddler's Reach, as it's
exactly.
Known.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And actually, Mike Krindler was who I had interviewed. And I think, Jeremy, you can probably relate to this in recording. You come prepared. You have all your questions, you have an idea of what people will say, but then there's this magic moment when something occurs that you absolutely couldn't even anticipate. As an example, the mechanism to strike that bell was not in place, mm-hmm. and so when I talked to Mike on the phone ahead of time, he told me that I was anticipating that we wouldn't even hear the bell. And so then as we came out onto the platform and he said, I'm going to take this block of wood,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to give you a two-strike pattern, you know, once every 20 seconds. You know, we have headphones on when we record. I got chills because not only was he going to ring the bell, but he also told me the pattern for this particular sound.
Mm-hmm.
It was just absolutely amazing. It was beautiful.
And in the exhibit, you've got Mike explaining all that.
Yes.
Which is great. Actually,
yes. And then he actually rings the bell. Yeah.
Okay. So this is a question for either or both of you. Just if you want to say a little bit more about if people come to the museum, especially if they're especially interested in this exhibit, for the reason to come here, what do they experience? What is it like when they come to the exhibit?
And so the exhibit really is a listening experience, mm-hmm. and the visitor will be immersed in coastal sounds and also be able to hear the historic objects that I had recorded.
Yeah,
and we try to, you know, give our visitors different ways to experience that sound. So when you walk into the exhibit, you can experience watching the sound file and hearing it on a nice big TV and sort of see the visual and hear the auditory component. Mm-hmm. Then we have these really cool sound domes that if you stand underneath, the sound is really intense. But if you take a step backwards or to the side, it's a little less intense. Yeah. And that's because it's directional sound. So you kind of get engulfed in it in a way. And then we have little almost like phone sticks that you can bring up to your ear and hear some of the noises, including the foghorns that we've been talking about. So kind of folks can choose the way they want to engage mm-hmm. with the sound, but also have different experiences as they go through the exhibit.
Yeah. Those sound domes that you just described are great. I stood under those, and yeah, the sound, you feel like you're there. It's so crystal clear.
Yeah, I think like especially with the buoy recordings, mm-hmm. When Diane went out on a boat in Casco Bay Harbor, and just you feel like you are on the boat with the captain and like listening to him explain what he's, you know, where he is and what you guys are listening to, and then the splashing of the waves. It's you're very much just a part of the environment.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite sounds, bellbuoys.
Oh, me too. Actually, I had been recording bellbuoys from the shore for years, mm-hmm. and I didn't have the idea to go out, have someone boat me out, until I got that fellowship and said, I'm going to just search for bellbuoys in different locations on the coast to record from shore. Mm-hmm. And then I had the thought, wow, it would be amazing to be boated out there. What happens so beautifully also in those recordings is that there's a beautiful rhythm between the waves splashing mm-hmm. and particularly the whistle buoy blowing. With the gong buoy, which is a metal plate that you know has three tones that ring. It's three metal plates, and that actually has a melody that is being played, which I didn't hear when I was actually recording it. And then when I got home and heard, you know, it's the length of three melodies from the sound piece that I created. Mm-hmm. And because of the beauty of the unevenness of the striker with the motion of the waves, you can almost not really hear that melody. Oh yeah, there it is. Now it ends, here it comes again. Mm-hmm. Really beautiful.
Yeah. And aside from that, what you just described, but just the interplay of the sound of the water and the bells is just always so beautiful. Mm-hmm. So we've touched on this already, but I don't know if you want to say anything more about the value of recording these things, these foghorns and bell buoys and other things.
Yeah. The foghorn is a very iconic sound, and it's similar to the sound of a train or church bells. It's a sound that's part of our collective memory. We all know those sounds, mm-hmm. Which I really love. I love that. You know, they actually beckon us or take us somewhere, those sounds. So by presenting the sounds as sound recordings, it brings them forward and reminds us of their presence.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really important, especially for our local visitors who come to the museum. But it's also sometimes something brand new for the visitors that we get from outside of New England. You know, we draw visitors from all over the world to this museum, and some of them aren't as familiar with a foghorn mm-hmm. or don't really know why they exist or why they're important, but we're able to, in a short snapshot, give them that information, give them that own memory so that they can take that and go. And, you know, I find that a lot of our visitors are coming to Maine specifically to come to the coast. And, you know, a lot of them are, we're a pit stop along the way to Acadia, which can't blame them. Acadia is great. Like, obviously people are going up there. But, you know, there is a recording in the exhibit of Scudic Point. And so perhaps if people are listening to that and then they go up to Acadia, maybe they're kind of can recall the experiences that they had here at the museum and the sounds and think about the way that it might be a little bit different, or maybe it's similar, mm-hmm. or it's entirely something new.
Yeah.
And I wanted to talk about, actually, the Scudic recording, because that's a perfect example of the elusiveness of sound, which is also what I like about sound. I had spent a week up at Arcadia, and I did a trip up to Scudic, mm-hmm. Winter Harbor, Prospect Harbor, all those peninsulas looking for sound.
Yeah.
And when I got to Scudic, toward the end of that loop that you make, there was a whistle buoy that was blowing loud and clear, just absolutely gorgeous.
I think I've heard that.
And I was like, okay, I have to know where I am right now so that I can come back and record this. And I do scouting trips without my equipment so that I know what I'm up against in terms of unwanted sound.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple days later, I came back and got to that exact location. The wind was still, you know, pretty much a gale, and I couldn't hear the whistle buoy.
Oh.
And so I said, okay, I'm here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to set up my equipment down by the water, and I'll wait. I'll wait mm-hmm. an hour. I had other locations that I was going to go back to. And here was this absolutely delicious incoming tide sound right at my feet. So that's how that recording uh-huh. came to be.
And happy accident.
Yes, very lovely.
Yeah. For people listening who don't know, the Scudic Peninsula is part of Acadia National, most of it is part of Acadia National Park. But as you mentioned, Prospect Harbor and Winter Harbor, parts of that area of the peninsula, and there's lighthouses there as well. But
oh, yes.
People miss something. If they go to Acadia National Park and don't go to the Scudic Peninsula, they're really missing out on something quite beautiful. So mm-hmm. they should check that out. So you kind of touched on this idea earlier, but I'm wondering about the aesthetics of these sounds. As we've been saying, they're so beautiful, the tones of the bells and the horns and everything. But do you see them as almost like a form of music?
I do, and if you know bell buoys, it can be accidental music because it's dependent on the motion of the wind, the water, and the strength of the wind.
Mm-hmm.
I have recorded boats creaking at docks, and I absolutely love that sound. And
there's some of that in the exhibit.
There
too.
Is some in the exhibit, yeah. And South Freeport Harbor actually was where the those recordings are from. I had been listening to South Freeport Harbor for years because I birdwatch. I go down there all the time, and kind of thinking about how am I gonna record here. The day that I went, I have never had a day's recording where I got so much content, so much I could use. The wind was actually blowing a gale, and I did have to, I always set up among the boats with the boats as my wind block. Mm-hmm. I do have a windscreen, but it doesn't work all the time. The rhythm that is created by the boats moving and creaking against the dock is just absolutely beautiful to me.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the wind goes through the masts, mm-hmm. and you hear that tinkling
yeah.
sound, which is also very musical. It's just absolutely beautiful.
It's like
yeah.
a symphony.
And I'm happy to introduce people to boats creaking as a wonderful sound, because I kind of feel like, you know, people really wouldn't think about that as a sound, as a coastal sound.
Mm. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely think so. And, you know, I think this exhibit has really, for lack of a better term, opened my ears up to how I experience sound and
yeah.
how I think about it. And something that has really struck me, you know, through my scholarship, through the exhibit, working with Diane, is thinking about how critical sound is to maritime environments. You know, you can't always see something.
Mm-hmm.
but you can usually hear something. You know, sound carries across water. Yeah. And that's, and so sound has to be critical to warn people of danger, but it also can be good. It can be fun. It can be, you know, people running across a beach and kids playing in the sand. There's so much to it that I hadn't really thought about the sea as being sort of a musical space, but mm-hmm. now I really do. And I touch on that in some of the exhibit text, because I think, you know, through the objects we weren't able to record, it's kind of like, oh, what were those sounds? What yeah. would it have been like to hear people yelling at each other through speaking trumpets, mm-hmm. or, you know, to hear the bell on the deck for, you know, okay, hey, shift change or watch change, you know, to think about whistles being blown, all of those things. And some of that is still obviously active today, but, you know, through automation and technological changes, a lot of that has disappeared and mm-hmm. been replaced with the sounds of motors and, you know, engines running. And while maybe not the most beautiful, they are still musical in a sense.
Yeah. You know, another thing I thought of as both of you were speaking is the way, you know, a good photographer can, when you look at the great photos, they'll draw your attention to a certain aspect of the scene. Mm. It's a way of looking at something and sort of isolating something. Whether it's an architectural detail or just a certain way of looking at something. And in a way, you're doing the same thing with sound. You're focusing in on these details and making people look at them anew, basically. So it reminds me of good photography in a way, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So in the description of the exhibit, it says that it, quote, encourages visitors to think critically about the soundscapes they encounter along Maine's coast and how they contribute to them, unquote. So what does that mean? How do all of us contribute to the soundscape?
Well, actually, people do interrupt the soundscape. And that is a kind of contribution to the soundscape with their own sounds.
Just a while ago, looking at your exhibit, I'm sitting there listening to some of the sounds, and a small child started crying just outside the exhibit. And that, maybe that's along the lines of what you're talking about.
It is exactly. And, you know, driving up, people leaving their engines on, mm-hmm. slamming of car doors, people talking with each other as they're, you know, say, at a lighthouse.
Yeah.
All of those sounds are interrupting the natural sounds that mm-hmm. are occurring, or even covering them up.
Right.
So a way to contribute to the soundscape is by pausing and taking a moment and really listening to the soundscape itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of ways sound gets interrupted these days.
Very much so.
Think of cell phones going off too, of course. So how long is this exhibit started in February, right,
yep.
the museum? How long will it be here?
The exhibit will be up through November of this year, 2024.
Catherine, let's just talk briefly about some of the other things in the museum. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously, there's a lot we can talk about.
Of course.
But for lighthouse buffs, I want to talk a little bit about the exhibit called Into the Lantern, A Lighthouse Experience.
Yeah.
The centerpiece of that exhibit is the beautiful second-order Fresnel lens from Cape Elizabeth, from the east light of the two lights there, Cape
yep.
Elizabeth. There's more to that exhibit than just the lens. Could you describe a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is an exhibit that was an addition to our building in 2017 and essentially provides an immersive experience for our visitors. So the centerpiece, of course, is the second-order Fresnel lens that came from the East Tower, as you said. And what's great is that we shot video on top of the lantern. And so you get to stand around as if you were actually on top of the lighthouse.
Yeah.
And experience some wind through some fans, hear the seagulls and the crashing waves, and watch this time-lapse video as it goes through the seasons throughout a whole year, and just see sort of what the view would have been like for a lighthouse keeper onto Casco Bay. Yeah. And so, and then surrounding that is all sorts of informational panels about the lighthouse itself, mm-hmm. when it was built, why it was built, and sort of how the Coast Guard then ends up giving us the Fresnel lens to display. Yeah. And then also sort of like timeline of the structure, and then some information about the many, many, many other lighthouses in Maine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a beautiful exhibit, and it's, if people just want to come and see a beautiful display of a large Fresnel lens, it's great from that standpoint, but it's also got so much more detail, as you said.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You can see the handholds, so you can see how the lighthouse yeah. keeper would have needed to be able to clean the lens, yeah. and you get to walk around it, mm-hmm. and you even get to see down into the tower, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And we recreated what the interior of it as it was built in the 1870s, which is really cool.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'd forgotten, I was looking at the website, the page about that exhibit on the museum's website, and it quotes me saying the most beautiful Fresnel lens display I've ever seen, something to that effect, which was absolutely true.
I was going to say, hopefully it's still true.
It's mm-hmm. a beautiful exhibit. People, anybody coming to this part of Maine has to come to this museum in general, but especially if they, even if they have a half hour to come in and look at that exhibit.
Absolutely. And then you can step mm-hmm. outside and you get the sight of another lighthouse
right.
with Doubling Point yeah. just across the river on the other side of the banks.
Uh-huh. And the Into the Lantern exhibit is just across the way
from the sound exhibit.
The sound exhibit. So if people come and only have, say, an hour, come and see those two exhibits. You won't be sorry. Any other things at the museum that you think people might be, people who are really into lighthouses or, say, navigation in general that they'd find interesting?
Well, of course, we have our permanent exhibit in the sort of back half of the Maritime History Building, which is our Maritime History of Maine. Mm-hmm. That'll be useful for folks who just kind of want an overview of sort of why Maine, why vessels, why here? Mm-hmm. And so that they can understand that and understand how different construction types and rigging helps change the usage of a vessel and its purpose. And then, of course, going outside, understanding how the actual shipbuilding process happened will sort of help understand how then ships were able to navigate.
Yeah. Well, people interested in lighthouses have to understand that lighthouses didn't exist in a vacuum. You know, they weren't, they were related to the whole
Correct.
Maritime
yeah.
scene, ships and navigation mm-hmm. and everything else. It's all part of the whole.
Yes.
So, and speaking of boats and cruises, you also, the museum offers lighthouse cruises.
Yes, we do. So, we offer, starting on May 18th of this year, we offer a daily and multiple times a day, lighthouse and nature cruise, in which you are able to see, as I mentioned before, a Doubling Point, but also the range lights and the Fiddler's Reach Fog Bell Tower, mm-hmm. All within an hour, and see the beautiful banks of the Kennebec River and see also the museum's campus from the river, which I yep. think is a really important vantage point for people to understand, because obviously we think about shipbuilding happening on the banks here, but then what would it have looked like to kind of look back? Yep. Or to come into Bath in that way. But we also offer a specific lighthouse lovers cruise on mm-hmm. our Merry Meeting vessel. And that is 4 hours, happens every Saturday, again, starting in middle of May. And on that tour, you get to see up to 10 different lighthouses.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great circuit around here, going along the Kennebec, seeing the lighthouses you mentioned. There's also Squirrel Point, Perkins mm-hmm. Island. And then you get out to the mouth, there's Pond Island and Seguin, which are spectacular.
Absolutely.
And kind of continue around the bend to Booth Bay Harbor, mm-hmm. some lights around there. It's a wonderful loop.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You get to see so much and mm-hmm. really quite a short amount of time. And I think, you know, even for those of us who are local and those of us who are from away, we don't necessarily realize how close together some of these lighthouses are, but how mm. necessary it was given the complicated, you know, environment and sort of landscape of our rivers and our coastline. There needed to be so many lighthouses. Mm-hmm. And so it's helpful then to jump on the Merry Meeting and be able to see so many in like I said, such a short amount of time in hindsight.
Yeah. Some of them you can drive to, some of them you can't.
Correct.
You have to get out in the
water. Yeah,
boat
you have to get
something.
Out in the water. I mean, is there any better mm-hmm. way to see a lighthouse than by the water?
So I have final questions for each of you. I have one final question for each of you, and these are for the these last questions are for bonus points. Okay, so so get ready. First, you, Catherine, what do you enjoy most? It can be multiple things, thing or things. What do you enjoy most about your work at the Maine Maritime Museum?
Oh, it's always the big question, isn't it? What do you enjoy the most? And it's like all of it, of course. But, you know, I am a born and raised Mainer. I have spent my academic and professional career understanding and learning and trying to share the history of Maine. And I could not ask for a better place to do that than Maine Maritime Museum. You know, I am not necessarily a trained maritime historian. Like I said, I'm trained in the decorative arts and material culture, but I get to take that knowledge and that understanding and see all of the ways that our history as a state and and our history as a region is so connected mm-hmm. to our waterways. And that's been something that's been really just fascinating for me to dive into and think about, exploring our collection, getting to share it with people, and hopefully allowing people to make connections with their own history, whether they knew it before or are learning it for the first time, and to see the ways in which the power of Maine's waterways have really shaped not only our state, our city, but us as a people.
Mm-hmm. Beautifully said. Sounds like it's a match made in heaven, for sure. So, Diane, a final question for you for bonus points, okay? What did you enjoy most about putting together the exhibit Lost and Found, Sounds of the Maine Coast?
And of course, that would be discovering and being able to record the historical objects, the sounding maritime objects. That, when I think back on that, the whole process was amazing. The moment when I hit return and searched foghorns and all the foghorns came up to the moments when I would beg Catherine, you know, when can I come and record this? And it kind of took a long time in between. We did several separate trips. The foghorns were the first. And then arriving and actually having the objects be presented to me on two carts in person, you know, seeing the objects in person. Yeah. It was just an absolutely beautiful experience and such a surprise. When I proposed this at the very beginning, I never imagined that I would have the honor, actually, to be recording these historical sounds. It was wonderful.
To have those actual historic objects.
Yeah, it was amazing. And also, with a photograph, I couldn't quite, you know, I didn't really know size-wise,
right.
Like how big these bells were,
yeah.
Or, you know, and to have that, you know, variation, you know, the little Seguin engine bell, you know, was very tiny, and the, you know, I mean, it was amazing all around. I do have to say that when we did go out and record the Fiddler's Reach Fog Bell on mm-hmm. the grounds of the museum, Catherine rang the bell with such gusto that I didn't need to do 1,000 takes.
If you knew anything about what our weather was like in June of last year, it pretty much rained every single day, and this day was no different, and we had just come through, you know, recording all the foghorns, and it was, of course, invigorating, but, you know, okay, now we're going to tramp outside and go, and I was like, we're going to get this done in one shot. I'm going to do it, and we're just going to ring it real hard, and it happened. Yeah. We went for it. Hey, this is why I love my job. I get to work with such cool people like Diane, and I get to really explore these objects in a way that, you know, I don't think my predecessors have been able to do, and I think it's really awesome that, you know, the museum has allowed me to do this and trusted me in my capabilities mm-hmm. to make it all come together.
Yeah. Well, it's awesome that you have such enthusiasm for it, too.
Well, I guess that's also the other thing. Every now and then I would think, how would this have even come to being if it wasn't Catherine who I was working with? Because Catherine's excitement and understanding
yeah.
and It was thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Pleasure all around.
You need to find somebody like that who gets it, who really gets what you're trying to
do.
Yeah, and not everybody does get these things, so I'm glad that worked out between the two of you. So, Diane and Catherine, this is fantastic. I feel like we could keep talking here, but probably need to end it at this point, but I hope we can talk some more in the future, both of you.
Absolutely.
So much to draw from. So thank you both so much. Thanks for having me here today, hosting me here, and for doing this interview. It's really been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you.
That is about it for this week. I hope you enjoyed the interview. We'll be back next Sunday with a new episode featuring the Horton Point Lighthouse on Long Island, New York. Reminder to visit uslhs.org to learn about the tours, the preservation grants, the passport program, and all the things the U.S. Lighthouse Society offers. If you listen to this podcast with Apple Podcasts, please be sure to rate and review us. With that, to all our regular listeners and our new ones, thanks so much for listening, and keep a good light. Let it shine, let it shine.